Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, make sure you check out all the other things that 1517 is doing, which is everything. I mean, videos, articles, conferences, academy. There's music. There's so much stuff over there that you could just spend your entire day just checking out stuff from 1517. So if you've never done it and you just listen to this podcast, you've never been to 1517.org, you got to change that. Go over there and check out everything else. Chad, last week, Solomon asked for some wisdom, got some wisdom. Two prostitutes decided to put that wisdom to the test. And this resulted in Solomon threatening to cut a baby in half and give each prostitute half of it. But one of them having her heart be warmed and say, don't do that, just give it to the other one, and this let Solomon know who the mother was. And that's sort of where we ended, was this with this sort of legendary act of wisdom by Solomon.
Yeah, we're going to shift from the high drama to seemingly pretty dry stuff. But, don't shut your podcast app down. Keep listening, because there's actually some pretty fascinating stuff in some of this. And then, you know, once we get past a long list of odd names, we're going to get into some pretty weighted language that takes us all the way back to Genesis. So we'll get a glimpse into just exactly how the kingdom of Solomon was sort of like an Eden. At least that's the way it's partially described. So that we'll pick that up when we get to verse 20. But right now we're in 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 1, which begins by saying that King Solomon was king over all Israel. So not just, of course, a portion of the kingdom, but the entirety. And by all Israel, it doesn't mean just Israel as opposed to Judah, but Israel here is used as that blanket term for the northern and southern parts of the kingdom. So he's reigning over everybody. And then we have a list of what are called his high officials. And I believe there's 11 of these. Some of these we've heard before. Many of them we have not heard of before. It starts out with a guy named Azariah, the son of Zadok. He's called the priest. I'm assuming this means the high priest. I mean, we're not told, but I'm assuming this is in reference to the high priest. So that's the very first official that's named. And then it goes on to describe his secretaries, his recorder, the commander of his army. We have met him several times. He was active in 1 Kings chapter 2, offing all those people that Solomon wanted to get rid of. And his name is Benaiah. So he was kind of he was Solomon's fixer, like Joab was David's fixer. So Benaiah, he was the commander of the army. In other words, he was Joab's replacement. And then there is kind of interesting inclusion here. We're told that Zadok and Abiathar were priests. Now, the reason this is noteworthy is because, remember, Abiathar was the guy that Solomon exiled. Yeah. Said, hey, you can't be a priest anymore. You got to go back home. And so he exiled him away from Jerusalem, away from the sanctuary, to go to his hometown. Now, either Abiathar is included here because this is sort of a kind of a general reference to back when Abiathar served as a priest under Solomon, or another possibility, which is somewhat entertaining, is that actually Solomon brought Abiathar back from exile. Now, I don't know which of those is true, but it does seem strange to me that his name is included here alongside Zadok when, back a couple chapters ago, he was exiled by Solomon.
Yeah, maybe so, it's just once a priest, always a priest. He's serving as a priest in exile, you know?
Yeah, maybe so, yeah.
But he's not dead, so he's still a priest.
Technically, yeah, this is true. It's true. So anyway, his name is there alongside Zadok. And then we have a few others listed, along with one guy named the king's friend. We've encountered that phraseology before. Didn't mean he was like the king's buddy. You know, they grew up together or something. This is a official title, probably like a counselor. So a close counselor type friend. And then at the very end, we're told about a fellow named Adoniram, who was in charge of the forced labor. Now, I bring that up now because we're going to encounter that several times in the next few chapters, all the way into chapters 9 and 10, this discussion of the labor force of Solomon. It's kind of a negative cast to that particular Hebrew word, because that is the form of that word was used way back in Exodus to describe the taskmasters in Egypt. So they were the ones who forced the labor upon the Israelites when they were in Egypt. And now we have the Israelites engaging in forced labor. So I'll save it for when we get to it, but we're going to encounter more than one situation where Solomon is enlisting both Israelites as well as foreigners to work in the building of his house as well as the temple. And at times it's a little bit fuzzy. It's like, are these guys willingly doing this? Are they being forced into this? Do they have, you know, any kind of say-so in this? Are they just kind of workmen who are partially paid, or are they slaves? Exactly what's going on here? So we'll encounter a few of those as we work our way through the chapters that are coming up. Just kind of keep that in mind, that already here in chapter 4, we're encountering the forced labor gangs. Then 7 through verse 19 describes 12 officers who are over Israel. Now, this is another kind of interesting detail, because you would assume, okay, you got 12 officers. I would assume anyway that these 12 officers are going to be representatives of the 12 tribes, and that these officers would then be bringing the taxation and the goods and all of that from their respective tribal areas back to Jerusalem. Except that doesn't work that way. When you start going through the list here, it does not match up with the tribal allotments that were given all the way back in Joshua. And many of these places are designated not according to the tribe to which they belong, but cities. It'd be kind of like suppose a newly elected American president came into office and he just did away with the old state boundaries and divided up the country into 50 new territories and named them after certain cities that were in those territories. So say he combined Texas and Louisiana and just called it the Houston Territory or something like that. That's more or less what is going on here with Solomon. And I suspect the reason he did this is that this is his political way of destroying old tribal allegiances. So he's realigning boundaries, realigning commitments, because his goal is to provide a more centralized, cohesive form of government, instead of there being kind of this tribal sort of governance going on out there. And then we have a list of their names, which we're not going to go through. The only one that's probably familiar to anybody is Ben-Hur because of the movie. Not the guy in the movie.
Different guy?
Yeah, different guy. It is one Hebrew detail here that's kind of odd about this list is, so you listen to these names: Ben-Hur, Ben-Decker, Ben-Abinadab. Where's another one? There's another Ben in there somewhere. It'd be like me. So my dad is named Carson. But like, instead of saying Chad Ben Carson, people just call me Ben Carson. So it's kind of strange here. There's no first names with some of these guys. So Ben-Hur just means son of Hur, and Ben-Decker just means the son of Decker, and Ben-Abinadab, son of Abinadab. So I don't know why their first names are not listed, but it's kind of an oddity in this list of names. So this is kind of a big overview of, so far anyway, we're going to hear more about it, of how Solomon is governing his kingdom. He's been given the gift of wisdom. He's got his personal counselors around him, these high officials who are his secretaries and counselors and recorders and whatnot. And then he's got these 12 officers who are spread out all over the land of Israel in these newly drawn territories. And each of them, as we'll see in a minute, is going to be responsible for providing the taxation, revenue, and other goods to Solomon. But anyway, that's the picture so far that we have of what's happening. You got any great insights to add to that theologically rich section?
Nope. Ben-Hur's good movie, though. I like that movie.
Yeah, it was a good movie, that's for sure. Okay, so the next section does have a lot more to it that is pretty fascinating for lots of reasons. And we encounter one of these actually right away. So let me read the first couple verses. This is 1 Kings 4, 20 and 21. Judah and Israel were as many as the sand by the sea. They ate and drank and were happy. Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates to the land of the Philistines and to the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life.
This is where you see that Solomon has this reputation of being this really good king, right? And we kind of talked about this a little bit last episode, where in his personal life and in his worship life, Solomon is not great, to be generous, to say he is not great. But if you just ask the people during his reign, if you're like taking the approval rating, it's probably pretty high, because it does seem like there's a lot of peace and there's a lot of prosperity. Everyone's happy. So if you just ask the one of the citizens, like, what do you think about, how do you think old Solomon's doing? They're probably going to say, it's going great.
Yeah, yeah. The Romans had their Pax Romana, and the Israelites have their, what, their the Pax Solomono? It really is. It's a piece of Solomon. And if you read through the rest of Kings, well, start reading with Saul. Saul and David's kingdoms were not anything like this. David's more than Saul's. But there was warfare, there were strife, there were coups going on, all kinds of problems that we've talked about in podcasts. And then if you read after Solomon, everything falls apart pretty quickly, and you never have any kind of this broad international Solomonic peace going on like you have here, nor do you have this high approval rating that Solomon's going to have. So, yeah, individually, in lots of different ways, Solomon's messed up. But as far as his governance of the kingdom, overall, especially in this opening chapter describing it, man, it's pictured in glowing colors.
Yeah, it seems like he really channeled that wisdom outwardly, right? Like I'm gonna rule in wisdom, but I'm not gonna live in wisdom.
Yeah, absolutely. That is what happens. And notice the image that are used here. The very first one, Judah and Israel were as many as the sand by the sea. Well, if you're familiar with Genesis and know the promises that God gave to Abraham, that's exactly why that particular metaphor is, or simile is used. Because Abraham has promised what? As many descendants as the, well, celestially as the stars in the sky, and then terrestrially as the sand and the seashore. So the reason that particular image is used is the way that the author is tapping us on the shoulder and saying, hey, guess what's happening in the time of Solomon? Many of the promises, not all, but many of the promises to Abraham are being fulfilled. So, and we'll see more of that actually in just a minute. So there are many as the sand by the sea. And then we have this kind of, you know, it's a generic description of the happiness of the people, but it's also a rich description. It says they ate and they drank and they were happy. In other words, there's plenty of food, plenty of wine, plenty of joy. So it's just kind of an overall description of the happiness, the satisfaction of the kingdom. And then there's a sort of a wordplay here going on. And when it says that Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms, the verb that's used there in Hebrew for rule is mashal. Mashal is also the word used for a proverb. So you could say that Solomon's reign was proverbial in quite a literal sense. So, and we're told later in the chapter that he also spoke many of these mashalim, these proverbs. So he ruled over all these kingdoms, and it's a pretty wide territory from the Euphrates to the Philistines to the border of Egypt. In fact, this is exactly the way back in Genesis 15, again, once more to go back to the days of Abraham, this is exactly the extent of the territory that was promised to Abraham, but that had not yet been realized all these centuries. In Genesis 15, 18 to 21, God says that he's going to give to the offspring of Abraham this land, and then here's the language, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates. So what God promised Abraham is now coming to pass during the reign of Solomon. And says they, that is all these other kingdoms, they brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. So it's sort of it's implicit, but one of the things that's happening here is that you've got the descendants of Abraham who are bringing under their wing, as it were, and it's a political wing, but nonetheless, bring under the wing the Gentiles. I think a lot of what's happening here is you're seeing in 1 Kings chapter 4 a foreshadowing of the kingdom of the true son of David. So, of course, he's going to reign over Jews and Gentiles, Christ. And he's going to, his kingdom is going to expand and expand and expand. And he's going to fulfill all the promises to Abraham. And in his kingdom, people will eat and drink and be happy. So what's happening in 1 Kings 4 is sort of a small window into the future, broader kingdom that we have in the true son of David. So this is sort of a sketching out of what is going to come to full flower once Christ is born and establishes his kingdom.
Yeah, it does seem like this sort of goodness and prosperity has extended out past Israel, right? And is sort of subdued any enemies or anything like that. That the reign of Solomon is at least, you know, horizontally kind of good for everybody. And so nobody really wants to fight him or have conflict, because it does seem like what he's making everything good for everyone.
Yeah, yeah. And when we work our way farther along, we'll discover there are some exceptions to that. It's sort of this is painting with a broad brush in chapter 4. We'll come across some details later where, you know, in fact, we'll see one of them in just a minute, where there's some cracks in the foundation, but you got to look closely to see those. They're going to broaden over time. But overall, yeah, that's exactly what's going on here.
We'll see, you see it with the Queen of Sheba and that sort of stuff, but his reputation is just that is something marvelous and great that you need to behold, and not something that you need to go conquer, but something that you almost need to go witness.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great contrast. Yeah, I mean, it's not like people were saying we need to invade Israel and conquer Solomon. They're more like, hey, let's go check this guy out.
Yeah.
Have you heard about what he's done? Have you heard about these judgments that he's made? You heard about these, you know, his building accomplishments? It's kind of one of the wonders of the ancient world, kind of magnetism that attracts people to come and see, you know, is it all true? We gotta check this out.
Yeah,
so it's legendary in that way.
It's sort of weird, like, you know, you say David to somebody back then, like David might strike fear in the heart of someone, where Solomon like strikes awe over a person, which is yeah. Different.
Yeah, it's different. It's a different kind of attraction that pulls people toward him. And it's not a direct parallel, but I think something like that was happening with Jesus too. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody who heard anything about him wanted to find out more. And maybe not always in a good way, but his attraction was irresistible.
Well, everybody that approaches Jesus in the Gospels approaches him because they heard a rumor.
Mm-hmm. People were talking about him. They couldn't help but talk about him.
I mean, you see that. I mean, come and see a man who told me all I ever did. I mean, this is directly from Scripture. There's people that go and make requests of Jesus, having never met him, having never seen him, but just because they have heard. And Solomon is like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's just one of those people that you would pay big money to go and just to be able to see him and to especially to be able to talk with him face to face.
Well, yeah, you know, and I know that we're going to get to this at some point, but in the Queen of Sheba instance, she hears all the, like, you know, normally like a rumor goes out or like a, you know, reputation goes out there, and you know, it gets greater and greater and greater, and it would be impossible for any person to live up to this huge, you know, portrait that's been painted of them. In Solomon's case, she comes and she says, like, they didn't do you justice. All these rumors, you surpassed all of them.
Yeah, you not only lived up to the hype. I mean, you like outdid. I just thought it was going to be great. It was far beyond anything that I had heard.
And again, this is all sort of horizontally, like if you're just looking at it, you know, from a, you know, from a worldly perspective, you say this guy's pretty impressive.
Yeah, yeah. And we get a kind of a detailed description of just, I guess, the richness of his kingdom would be one way to describe it. And then the effects that it had, not just on him. So don't get the impression that this is just all about Solomon, because the individual Israelites are enjoying the munificence of his kingdom as well. We're told, verse 22 through 23, about the provision that was provided for his table. So, you know, so many 30 cores of fine flour, 60 cores of meal. Then you have seven different animals listed here that were regularly on his menu: oxen, cattle, sheep, deer, gazelles, roebucks, fowl, which are probably geese. Of course, these aren't just like Solomon's eating all this, or just his immediate family. It's kind of the picture of the king's table, right? And he invites people to it. And so this would be the provision for the meals that would feed Solomon, his family, as well as all the people who were part of his entourage there in Jerusalem. Then verse 24 uses an interesting verb here. It says he had dominion over all the region west of the Euphrates, from Tifsah to Gaza, over all the kings of the Euphrates. The verb that's used there is the same verb that's used back in Genesis 1:26. So in Genesis 1, God says, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them radah, let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the heavens, and over all the other animals." Now that's the same verb that's used back here in 1 Kings 4. Solomon radah, he had dominion over all the region west of the Euphrates, and so on and so forth. One of the implications of this, I think, again, is this is sort of a picture of him. He's an Adam kind of figure. He's everything that we've been talking about, and he's also having dominion. He's ruling over these vast territories. And as we'll see at the end of the chapter, he has wisdom that is interested in all these various aspects of creation, from the cedars to the hyssops to the beasts, birds, reptiles, fish. And so he's really being portrayed here as this Adam kind of figure, full of wisdom, who has this vast, almost seemingly idealistic kingdom. And so it's probably the first person we've encountered since Genesis that most closely resembles a picture of what Adam was destined to do and to do and to be, which of course makes his demise all the more regrettable, because he is elevated to such a high extent that when those cracks in the foundation begin to show, then and everything crumbles, it's even a greater disappointment than it would have been had he not been this way. So anyway, he rules over all these people. He has peace on all sides around him. Judah and Israel lived in safety from Dan even to Beersheba. So there's your northern and southern boundaries. And then we have this proverbial expression that occurs elsewhere in the Old Testament as well, such as in Micah chapter 4, that every man under his vine and under his fig tree all the days of Solomon. So it wasn't just the king who was becoming rich and impoverishing everybody else. His success, his wealth, his peace, all of that flowed down to everybody, so that, as it says here, everyone was happy. They were peaceful under their vine and under their fig tree, which becomes, in the prophets, an image of the eschatological kingdom, the kingdom of the Messiah. So this is another reason why 1 Kings 4 is kind of a prototype of what the Messianic kingdom is going to be like.
Yeah, the idea is there's a lot of grapes on those vines and a lot of figs on those trees.
Yeah, just reach up, pluck what you want, yep, and you're good to go. Okay, so all that's great. Now, verse 26 introduces us to what I think is one of these foreshadowings of problems to come. Because after the description of the food he has and the dominion he has and how this extends out to individual Israelites, we're told that Solomon also had 40,000. The Septuagint has 4,000. So who knows which one's right, but either way, there's a bunch. 40,000 or 4,000 stalls of horses for his chariots, and 12,000 horsemen. Now, why would that be a big deal? Why isn't this just another description of the wealth and the power of his kingdom? Well, yeah, it is, but it also is in direct violation of Deuteronomy chapter 17, where Moses had laid down the requirements for the king. And one of the things the king was not to do, he wasn't to go to Egypt, and he was not to collect horses, because horses are not for roping steers. Horses are for chariots, and horses and chariots are, of course, the war machine of the ancient world. So anytime you have horses and chariots mentioned, almost without exception, it's a negative image. So this is sort of, I think, is kind of a ticking time bomb. It's the narrator's way of telling us, hey, everything I'm saying sounds really great, and it is, but there's problems. And these problems will become more and more obvious as we go on.
I'm sure Solomon would say, I'm not planning on using any of this. This is all deterrent. That's what this is. It's just to let people know that I could have, I'm out here and I'm known as a wise king and stuff. I'm not really known as a warrior. So I'm going to need to let people know that there's a lot of horses and chariots back there. Just so you know.
Yeah. I'm not going to drop any of these bombs, but I've got a bunch of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's kind of the idea here. So verse 26 is, verse 26 is kind of a ticking time bomb, telling us there's problems ahead. 27, picking up there, it says those officers supplied provisions for King Solomon and for all who came to King Solomon's table, each one in his month. So there's this picture of everyone enjoying a feast. There's plenty of food. Everybody's happy. Solomon's table has not only plenty of food, but everyone has filled up the chairs. There's nothing lacking. There's verse 28, there's barley, straw for the horses, and swift steeds they brought to the place where it was required, each according to his duty. So more talk about horses there in verse 28. So good, a lot of good, a little bit of bad, and that little bit of bad will be the leaven in the whole lump as we go on. Then finishing out verses 29 through 34 continues the description, focusing more on Solomon personally and how wise he was. God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding beyond measure and breadth of mind, like the sand on the seashore. There's that image again of the sand on the seashore. So far, no one has ever described me that way. You, Dan? No one has ever said, you know, Chad has wisdom just like the sand on the seashore.
Yeah, beyond measure. I tried to quantify the wisdom that Dan has and found out that it could not be measured. It was so much.
Right, yeah. Yeah, not something that someone has said of me, nor actually of anybody else that I know of. I mean, it is quite a, and I understand it's hyperbolic, but still, I mean, that is quite a statement. Wisdom and understanding, you can't even measure it.
Yeah, beyond measure is quite a way to say something. If someone has anything that is beyond measure, you're saying that they have a tremendous amount of this thing. Like, it's not worth trying to count it. It's so much that you don't bother trying to count it.
Yeah, there's not a number for the IQ here. This is beyond. So that Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the people of the East and all the wisdom of Egypt. So wisdom here wasn't just an Israelite thing. Wisdom, you can read in the ancient Near Eastern literature, and wisdom was a big deal in a lot of countries. I mean, they had schools that taught various kinds of wisdom. And by wisdom here, we don't just mean, of course, being smart, but it's knowing all sorts of, it's kind of a holistic understanding of how the world works, how humanity works, how you govern. There's a lot of very practical things to wisdom. Egypt was certainly known for its schools of wisdom. In fact, if you go to the book of Acts in Stephen's speech, Stephen's sermon, his harangue, whatever you want to call that, one of the most fiery sermons in the New Testament. He says in Acts 7:22, Moses was instructed in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. And he was mighty in his words and deeds. So Stephen himself is referencing this famous legendary wisdom of Egypt. But we're told Solomon surpassed all that.
Yeah, we're about to hear a group of people that Solomon was wiser than, that I think is going to really drive home to the listener just how wise he was, because I'm sure these names are names that the listener is familiar with.
Yes, yes, yes. So ready yourself. He was wiser than all other men, wiser even than, drumroll, Ethan, the Ezraite.
We all know how wise he was.
Yeah, gosh. And Haman. I mean, not just Haman, too.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And if those were not enough, Calcol and Darda, the sons of Mahol. Just let that sink in.
Yeah, just
sink in for a minute. Now, I did do a little bit of digging here, and if you look long and hard, you will actually find Ethan and Haman mentioned. They were respectively the authors of two of the Psalms.
There you go.
Haman wrote Psalm 88, that really, really depressing, dark psalm that ends literally in darkness. And then Ethan wrote Psalm 89. So I think it's kind of cool that this is a side issue, but you know, that these two names that are side by side end up having two psalms that are side by side.
There you go.
Points to the fact that, you know, when it came to putting the 150 psalms together, they didn't just kind of shuffle them like a deck of cards and like, oh, here we go. Well, look, Haman and Ethan's psalms are out together. No, I'm sure that was definitely on purpose. But anyway, those two guys do come up. They were evidently not only wise, but they wrote poetry, which was pretty typical of wise men. In fact, that's a good segue into the next verse, because verse 32 tells us that Solomon also spoke 3,000 proverbs. I have not got anywhere close to 3,000 on my list of Chad written proverbs. Proverbs were just simply wise sayings, pithy wise sayings.
So you're trying to get to 3,000, so you're like, Solomon wrote the Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, and just attribute like any wise portion of scripture to Solomon.
Yeah, pretty much the way it goes.
We got to get to 3,000 here, people.
And he was a songwriter too. It's kind of funny. You know how many songs he wrote? Not 1,000. 1,005.
Yeah, this is one of those rare times where the scriptures have like a very specific number.
Yeah, not 3,005 proverbs, but 1,005 songs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Wait. Anytime there's a very specific number like that, you got to think, oh, well, I guess it actually was 1,005.
Yeah, we know of one.
We know of one. Or two. So there's a psalm by Solomon.
There you go.
So Song of Songs, and we have a psalm. But like, what happened to the rest? It is kind of odd when you see things like that and you're like, well, this guy was the smartest, wisest guy. So what happened to the other 1,003 of his songs?
Yeah, can we get those?
They're probably buried in some library in Jerusalem that archaeologists haven't discovered yet. Maybe in time they will be found. And then when he wasn't writing proverbs or writing songs, he was talking about trees. He spoke of trees. From the cedar that is in Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of the wall. We kind of have the whole stretch there, because cedar was the tallest tree. So you go from the biggest, the cedar, to the hyssop, which was a plant that was so small that grew out of a wall. Of course, we know the hyssop because it was used in many rituals. Hyssop was a good plant for absorbing liquids, using kind of as a paintbrush.
Yeah, it's like like a spongy bush.
Yeah, like a spongy bush. Yeah, so used it back in the Exodus, right, to paint, and then it was used in various rituals described in Leviticus, and shows up in the Gospels, right? Is that John?
Yeah, attach it to a hyssop branch, yeah, so, and stick it up there. I mean, and David, you have cleansed me with hyssop, which you can tie right back into that John text where Jesus is paying for David's sins. He's offered the hyssop. So, yeah, the hyssop appears all over the place.
Yeah, hyssop is one of those things. You know, sometimes you come across these tiny little things like that where you could do a whole sermon series on just something like that, because all those stories connect in one way or another. I mean, you're linking the Passover to the Psalm 51, to the crucifixion of Christ, and then you're including these rituals by the priest where hyssop was used. So I love details like that, because it's like, when we start paying attention to tiny things like that, you realize, man, this is all so deeply interconnected that you can see how God was at work, kind of pulling all this story into one narrative.
Yeah, I mean, when David says, "Cleanse me with hyssop," that if that was the only time it was mentioned, that would be weird. Of course, why would he say something like that? He is asking God to sort of soak up his sin and take it away from him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the fact that works its way all into the crucifixion is like just perfect.
Yep.
There's probably a preacher out there listening. There you go.
There you go.
We just helped you out with your next sermon series on hyssop. Just make sure that you include 1 Kings 4:33. Solomon talked about the hyssop. I'm assuming this is sort of he just studied these things. He says he spoke about them, but he was presumably just interested in the things of nature. He was a biologist, a botanist. I mean, he was early scientist.
I know this. If you could somehow know for a fact that the cross was made of cedar and that Christ was offered hyssop, you really have something going on here.
Yeah. You certainly would. Yeah, that would be, man, that verse would just blow up with significance. So he talked about the plant life, and he also talked about beasts and birds and reptiles and fish. Now, all those show up in Genesis chapter 1, and this is another, of course, trees and plants do too. So this is another one of those Genesis 1 kind of echoes. There's a lot of Genesis stuff going on here. All the Genesis 12 and 15 Abraham references to the sand and the seashore and the territories of Solomon's reign. And now we have this language of creation that's in verse 33 about plants and trees and beasts, birds, reptiles, fish. So you got the dry land represented. You've got the seas. You've got the heavens represented with all these different animals. So Solomon studied all of those. And there's a talk of this also in Ecclesiastes, another one of those books traditionally attributed to Solomon.
Yeah, you definitely get the impression. I mean, obviously, David was a psalmist. I mean, the psalmist. And so they're not altogether different in that sense. You have Solomon writing songs and that kind of thing. And you have Solomon talking about nature. And when David writes psalms, he talks about nature a lot, uses a lot of illustrations drawn from creation. But I don't know if David was sitting around studying these things. You get the impression that Solomon had a lot more time to engage in this sort of stuff than David did early in his reign. I don't think David had a lot of time to be like, I'm going to take the week and think about fish or something. I don't think David did. That was not something that David was. He did not. He was not afforded the peace and prosperity to do such a thing.
Yeah, you know, like after he collects all those Philistine foreskins for a dowry, he doesn't go, you know, I'm gonna take a week off and I'm gonna study hyssop.
No. Just,
he was way too busy as a warrior.
You don't get the impression that David was doing a lot of bird watching.
No, I don't think that was happening.
He was doing some Philistine watching, but
plenty of that.
Different.
And then the chapter wraps up verse 34 with what we alluded to earlier about his international fame. It says people of all nations came to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. Now we'll see an example of that later on, but this sweeping kind of statement here is indicative of the fact that everybody was talking about Solomon. He was the guy during this time period, and so people from all over the place, leaders as well as others, came to sit at his feet and to see what he had to say.
Yeah, and this is a pretty unique thing. I mean, there's not anything else like this.
No, this is it. I mean, you don't have any other kings where people are clamoring to get an audience with them. But Solomon, yeah, which is why I think this whole chapter is described in this way to show us this idealistic, Eden-like picture of what the Messianic kingdom is going to be like. There's plenty of, you know, kind of underlying problems with some of this, but overall, that's the impression that we're given, is this is a pre-portrait, if you will, of what's going to happen when the Son of David comes.
That's right, and that is all the time we got. Wrapped up chapter 4, so that's good. Next week, we got to get prepared to build the temple. So
we got to cut some cedars down.
Yeah, we cut some cedars down and get a temple built. So we'll cover that next week. Chad, I'll see you then.
See you then.